At the onset of the Arab Spring, Ba'athah Syria was considered the most restrictive police state in the Arab world. Grievances that had been festering for years ultimately found an outlet in early 2011 as Syrians joined the wider tide of the Arab Spring. Inspired by the uprisings across the Middle East, Syrian teenagers in southern Daraa scrawled anti-regime graffiti on public walls. They were arrested, held for days and tortured, in turn prompting local demonstrations that called for their release. Peaceful protests rapidly spread across Syria as the focus shifted to the regime of Bashar al-Assad. As the marches gained momentum, the regime unleashed its military firepower. Police and security forces employed water cannons and tear gas, physically beat protesters firing live ammunition. Tanks were used for the first time against demonstrators, and snipers took positions on the rooftops of masajid. The regime also deployed the dreaded Shabiha death squads, consisting of fervent Alawi loyalists that were ordered to execute sectarian attacks on the protesters, torture Sunni demonstrators, and engage in anti-Sunni rhetoric. Ba'athah's security forces intensified their campaign of large-scale detainment and torture of Syrian protesters, journalists, and activists across state prisons. On April the 9th, 2012, a 13-year-old boy, Hamza al-Khatib, was arrested by forces of the Mukhabarat during protests in the village of Sa'ida. For nearly a month, Hamza was held in police custody, where he endured regular torture and mutilation of his body. On May the 24th, the Mukhabarat released the tortured and mutilated body of Hamza al-Khatib to his family members. A video of Hamza's mutilated body was uploaded online, triggering large-scale protests in Daraa, during which residents defied the military siege and came out in large numbers to protest against the repression. These crimes led to large-scale desertions within army ranks, and further defections of officers who began forming a resistance movement. The Syrian revolution escalated into a full-blown civil war by mid-2012. An array of poorly organized opposition groups by now had formed rebel brigades and seized key cities in the north. The Free Syrian Army, formed by defectors, launched operations against regime forces. Major cities like Aleppo and Homs became battlegrounds. In response, Bashar al-Assad unleashed his air force, artillery, and even chemical weapons against civilians. Foreign intervention began to rear its head. The governments of Shia Iran and Iraq and Lebanon-based Hezbollah supported Assad, while Turkey, Qatar and Saudi Arabia played a role in supporting some anti-Assad rebels. Around 2013, the Assad regime was facing catastrophe when many officers defected from the Syrian army to rebel groups that helped them seize much of northern and eastern Syria from the regime, and they were planning a final assault on Damascus itself. The regime lost Aleppo, Idlib and Raqqa, which became the first provincial capital to fall into opposition hands. Opposition forces also controlled parts of Damascus suburbs. The al-Assad regime was forced to give up fighting for most of the country in order to defend Damascus. It was at this critical juncture for the regime that the murky face of ISIS began to rise. From its base in Iraq, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's ISIS proceeded to move into Syria, regularly crisscrossing the Iraqi-Syrian border. ISIS seized control from the rebel groups of much of eastern Syria, including Raqqa, Deir ez-Zor, and parts of the Aleppo province. In early 2014, when ISIS captured Raqqa, they made it the de facto capital of their so-called Khilafah. What ISIS did was enter into Syria when the Assad regime was about to collapse, and rather than join the rebel groups on their assault on Damascus, they began taking territory that was already under rebel control. As a result, the rebel groups were forced to take on ISIS, who forced them to fight on two fronts, splitting their resources and attention, and this took the pressure off the forces of Assad. The timing of the ISIS intervention was perfect for the regime. ISIS thus served the agenda of propping up the regime, and serious questions have been raised on alleged links and support it received from the Assad regime itself. 2015 and 2016 featured growing Russian military intervention, especially air power against the Syrian Mujahideen. Russia deployed some of its most sophisticated weaponry and air defense systems. The roles of Hezbollah and Iran deepened too. Russia's intervention in Syria proved to be pivotal in saving the Assad regime from collapse. Russian forces stabilized and strengthened Bashar al-Assad's government by providing air power and conducting airstrikes against rebel groups. The US, despite its public portrayal of opposing Assad, ultimately backed his regime to maintain its interests. It coordinated with Russia and Iran to intervene, ensuring the Syrian regime's survival while supporting select rebel groups to control the revolution's direction. Iran's intervention saw the country mobilize its resources and provide critical military forces, money and weapons. While Russia's intervention was the turning point, Iran laid the groundwork for this and provided significant fighters on the ground, who Russia provided air cover to. This saw al-Assad's dependency on Iran deepen, leading to long-term Iranian influence in Syria's military, economy, and politics. Iran also deployed the Revolutionary Guard Corps, particularly the so-called Quds Force, which played a leading role in advising and coordinating Syrian government forces. Iran also recruited, trained, and funded thousands of Shia militias that carried out massacres across Syria and helped regime forces retake towns and cities that were lost by the regime. In parallel to this, Lebanon's Hezbollah provided crucial manpower where Assad's army was crippled due to many units defecting to the rebels. With this external support, the Assad regime retook territory and consolidated its control over most of the country. By the end of 2016, it had retaken major cities, including Aleppo, as well as areas across Syria's strategic western spine. In 2017, it knit together patches of the countryside to cement the restoration of government power. By mid-2018, it also recaptured strategic suburbs surrounding Damascus for the first time in 5 years. It then turned its sights further south to Daraa, the birthplace of the uprising. It seized the city, as well as most of the southwest of Syria, by the summer of 2018. On the sidelines of these developments were the Kurds, comprising about 10% of Syria's population and concentrated in the northeast of the country. The Kurdish groups consisted of multiple factions that coalesced into the Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF. The largest faction amongst them was the Syrian Kurdish Democratic Union Party and its armed wing, the YPG. As part of its meddling in Syria, the US deployed special forces to work with the SDF. The SDF, with support from the US, took control of the areas of Hasaka, Raqqa and Deir ez-Zor. This gave them control of the most oil-rich region of Syria. These Kurds also allowed the USA to maintain forces in this area.
Bu azgın devlet, bu terör devleti...
Wary of the role of Kurdish forces, Turkey provided financial support, arms, political coordination, and intervened in North Syria, which saw its influence grow over elements of the opposition. An important stronghold for the opposition to Bashar al-Assad from the onset of the revolution that remained such and that Assad was unable to retake was Idlib, in the northwest of Syria. Many of the rebel groups that were either defeated elsewhere or entered into agreements ended up in Idlib. A consortium of different rebel groups controlled Idlib, and over the years, control of the area shifted due to infighting, external interventions, and battles with the Syrian regime. The main groups in Idlib were Jabhat al-Nusra, who had split from ISIS. Ahrar al-Sham was one of the largest groups during the uprising, with tens of thousands of fighters, as well as the Free Syrian Army, which was backed by Turkey. In 2016, the head of Jabhat al-Nusra, Abu Muhammad al-Jawlani, who previously had an association with ISIS but broke it off, rebranded his group to Hay'at Tahrir al-Sham, or HTS. Jawlani then turned against Ahrar al-Sham, defeating it and taking over Idlib. HTS absorbed and eliminated the smaller factions, becoming the dominant force by 2017 in Idlib. HTS established a civilian front called the Syrian Salvation Government as its political and administrative arm. This entity functioned like a state, with a prime minister, ministries and local departments overseeing sectors such as education, health and reconstruction, while maintaining a religious council guided by the Sharia. HDS prioritized stability, public services and reconstruction, and showcased Idlib as a model of success under HDS rule, enhancing both his group's legitimacy and Jolani's own political aspirations. But it has not been without controversy. Public protests have been held against HDS in the areas it controlled, and the likes of Bilal Abdul Karim, who were imprisoned by it, have accused HDS previously of a betrayal of the ideals of justice.
Well, my past relationship with them was good. What does that mean? Well, that means that I would go to battlefront with some of their fighters. I would do interviews with some of their with some of their members. But then once I started to do interviews with the mother of one individual who was killed under torture in Hayat Tahrir Sham's prison. His name is Marwan Unki. I did an interview with his mother. Their politics towards me changed. Some of their members said to me, Bilal, we thought you were cool. And I said, well, you know what? If covering up your torture means that I'm cool, then you know what? Go back and tell them that I'm not cool and I'm not going to be cool, because that's not what I came here for. So in the past, our relationship was good and it was very amicable. But it changed around 2018 when I was obligated to do reports about torture and some of the wrongdoing that they were doing.
By 2022, Bashar al-Assad seemed to have successfully rode the wave of opposition against him and appeared in a dominant position. Arab states started rapprochement with Syria. On the 19th of May 2023, the Assad regime regained Syria's seat at the League of Arab States summit that took place in Jeddah, marking the end of over a decade of regional boycott and Assad's exclusion from Arab circles. Amidst this buoyant outlook, Assad overlooked the fragility of his rule. The Syrian economy was in a state of severe crisis, with widespread poverty, significant infrastructure damage, and a pressing need for international assistance to facilitate recovery and reconstruction efforts. Manufacturing, production, and services were all in a disastrous state after 13 years of war. And this meant that soldiers, security officials, and those linked to the regime didn't receive salaries. And corruption was rife, with militia groups helping themselves to the country's resources. Cracks began to appear in the relationship between Assad and Iran and Hezbollah themselves, the parties that were pivotal in keeping Assad in power. Then came the 7th of October, 2023, and the dramatic changes Gaza brought throughout the region that are still in motion. Russia's entanglement in Ukraine and Hezbollah's dramatic loss of its top brass created a vacuum in Syria that left the Assad regime extremely vulnerable. The HDS group in Idlib spotted the opportunity. Whilst there are many theories and suspicions about external hands behind the dramatic recapture of the country and the fall of Assad, the officials we spoke to were adamant that the victory achieved in December 2024 was purely organic. When asked which hidden hands could be behind the new rulers of Syria and the fall of Assad, the Mufti of Halab told us, "It is Allah and the blood of the Shuhada that are behind these developments. Don't look at the final picture of victory," he said. "Look at the work that led to this point." By this, he was referring to the extensive work HDS made to unify variant groupings in Idlib, establish a working administration, and then prepare for a decisive battle against the regime.
They really did develop. And over the last years in Idlib, when it seemed like nothing was happening because the battle lines remained static, and the Syrians, or the revolution, if you like, including HDS, was pushed into a narrow strip of land on the Turkish border, but during that time, they were organizing themselves and rethinking things.
No external powers participated in our final battle against the regime, said another official. This battle was by divine tawfiq. We prepared extensively, and after all the preparation came an unexpected degree of divine help, he said. We were confident of victory, but didn't expect it so
quickly.
Another official in the new government said that the HTS November 2024 operation just had the modest objective of retaking Aleppo. However, when a main operations center of the regime, Russia, Iran and Hezbollah commanders were taken out, communications in the Syrian regime army were plunged into disarray and Syrian soldiers surrendered en masse. With Halab falling so easily, there was no turning back. City after city was taken within just 13 days, culminating with the fleeing of Bashar al-Assad and the liberation of Damascus.
We are in the center of Damascus. I'm wearing this helmet. Gunfire, celebratory gunfire. People are on the street celebrating their new reality, the new Syria. We're going to try to show you as much as we can of the Syrian capital. Let me tell you where we are. This is the Umayyad Square. This is the center of the Syrian capital. And this is the Syrian state TV and radio, which is now under the control of the opposition. People are in the... There's a lot of celebratory gunfire. That's why we're wearing this helmet.
The roots of tyranny were cut off. Statues of Assad were toppled, and prisoners were freed amidst shocking scenes in torture dens like Sedanaya. The fighters proceeded to exert control in an orderly way. Looting and harming of civilians were largely absent, and rank and file soldiers of the regime who surrendered and handed over their weapons were allowed to be set free. It was at 6:18 a.m. on December the 8th, 2024, that the fighters declared Damascus liberated.
The city of Damascus has been liberated. The tyrant Bashar al-Assad has been toppled. All the prisoners have been released from the prison of Damascus. We wish that all our fighters and citizens preserve and maintain the property of the state of Syria. Long live Syria.
The swift fall of Assad's regime was met with shock and surprise throughout the world, including the Syrian people, with many admitting that it was nothing short of a divine miracle. Geopolitical commentators compared the collapse of the Ba'athist regime to the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, pointing to the broader geopolitical shifts that occurred after both the events.
Despite the historic series of events, the world is now left wondering, what's next for the Syrian people?